It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So the question we're asking is, how can the fight against AIDS decades ago, how can that inform our fight today against the coronavirus? And that enemy infection in the 80s and 90s was HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus, which could have led to the life-threatening AIDS. And health officials say that the AIDS epidemic resembles the current pandemic in at least one way, that it caught our government flat-footed and ill-prepared for a global health crisis. What do you remember about the AIDS crisis of the 80s? How did you feel during that time? How did you see health authorities respond? Let's talk about that history. 800-642-1234. Richard Wagner is an activist and author. His most recent book is called We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History. And his next book on our state's gay history is due out in September. Dick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Glad to be here as always.
As you see the pandemic unfold in front of us here in Wisconsin, where do you see the echoes of how Wisconsin responded to the AIDS outbreak in the 80s?
There's so many echoes. One of the issues about AIDS was what to call it. Originally, it was called gay-related immune deficiency before they finally settled on AIDS. We've had some naming issues with our current COVID-19 as well, floating around. Testing was an issue because a lot of gay men were concerned that the testing that was there didn't really tell them what to happen in the rest of their lives. There was no counseling initially, and that became an important thing in terms of testing. And there was talk of quarantine, not the sort of self-quarantine, but of sometimes rounding up those who tested positive and putting them in separate places rather than in their own homes. So they're just like echoes of this that are bouncing through my mind again about the panic and hysteria that was out there then.
How was testing conducted and how did it ramp up in that era?
Well, testing was originally put forward as a way to protect the blood supply since they found that was one of the ways that they were spreading HIV, particularly to hemophiliac patients. And so they wanted to test as much as possible. But since testing could be a marker for homosexuality, many gay men did not feel comfortable with sort of public testing, and they wanted alternative test sites where there could be privacy as well as counseling provided.
Did you see those support structures after the testing, or were these people who went to get tested, did they have that support afterward?
In the alternative test sites, yes, the support was provided. But the main impetus of the testing was to protect the blood supply. It was not to support the individuals. And so, you know, in some ways, the testing, mass testing that's trying to be provided now doesn't really do much, as far as I can tell, to support individuals who might actually find what their test results are.
What was the quarantining like?
There, in the end, wasn't quarantine, but there was a lot of attempts to use HIV as a way to screen people out of things. The Racine School Board wanted to remove anyone who was homosexual on the assumption that they had AIDS from their schools. They also wanted to keep out all the students. You may remember the name Ryan White, who was a student in Kokomo, Indiana, in which some of the AIDS bills were named after in terms of the Ryan White support. You know, the whole question of what to do with students who were possibly HIV positive was a big issue that was flaming around the country and in Wisconsin. Most schools tried to take a compassionate approach based on actual health concerns rather than the hysteria and misinformation that was out there.
We're looking back at the response to AIDS in Wisconsin amid our current pandemic. Our guide is author and activist Dick Wagner, who studied the history of Wisconsin's gay community. You can join in with your history and perspective, 800-642-1234. Dick, how quickly did state and local authorities in Wisconsin recognize the big issue they had, that AIDS as a new public health threat that, and they had to take action. What was that like?
Wisconsin was actually much better at responding than the federal government. Again, you had mixed level of responses at different levels of government. President Reagan, for a long while, even refused to say the word AIDS. But Governor Tony Earle, who was governor in Wisconsin in 83, had created the governor's council, and our early meetings focused on AIDS. Governor Earle wrote a supportive letter to an application to the national health agencies for a grant to assist Wisconsin early on. He had Linda Rivets, who was Secretary of Health and Social Services, create an early AIDS advisory group. And Katie Morrison, who was Director of the Division of Health, initially started reallocating funds. So the state response was pretty good. Another way the state was different than the federal government was that under the Reagan administration Justice Department, they ruled that it was okay to fire people who had AIDS from employment. But the state Equal Rights Division, Mary Fran Tryon, she made a ruling that it was a disability under state law. And because we had a law protecting discrimination on sexual orientation, that you couldn't actually fire people who were showing HIV positive or AIDS from employment in this state. So the state response was early and strong, quite different from what the federal government was doing.
How was it like inside the community at this time as these federal and state initiatives were coming down? Was there a sense of people feeling not alienated, or did, you know, were people on their own?
Some people were on their own, but the community quickly formed a support organization, the Madison AIDS Support Network, Milwaukee AIDS Project, and the Center Project in Green Bay. These were primarily initiated and initially supported by the gay and lesbian community in the state because they knew they needed to do something for their own self-defense, since even with a positive state government, the responses, were slow in coming as to what was happening. So the community needed to take, I can remember going to so many Sweet Sunday fundraiser events to raise money. Small amounts of money were provided to AIDS in the early days, in contrast to the millions, billions, and even trillions that are now being thrown at the corner of COVID-19 crisis. So it was a lot of sort of by the bootstraps effort by the community to initially get a response going.
What did these nonprofits provide? What were the services?
They helped provide prevention information, risk reduction kind of information. At that point, it wasn't masks. It was condoms that were being distributed to try and reduce risk. And they would also provide patient support, which was very crucial because many of the medical profession was still needing to be educated about how to deal with sexual orientation issues. And some of the early pioneers who had worked within the gay community at STD sites were in the forefront of that battle to expand the medical education about the health needs of the lesbian and gay community.
We're talking with author Dick Wagner about lessons from the AIDS crisis of the 80s and what insights carry over to the global health crisis of today. What do you think health authorities learned from the AIDS epidemic? Did they become better prepared to handle the coronavirus outbreak? How do you think Wisconsin's health system could be better prepared for future outbreaks? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dick Wagner here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the intersection of HIV/AIDS and COVID-19. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 23rd International AIDS Conference gets underway Monday. It is virtual. Many talks will look at the crossover between HIV and COVID. What lessons do you think were learned from the AIDS epidemic, or what have health authorities not learned and is still a problem? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Dick Wagner, the author of a book on Wisconsin's gay history, and he has another one in the works. He stays with us. So, Dick, there is so much anticipation for a vaccine that could be a long way off with a very high price tag. Take us back to the 80s. What was access like to medication or treatment for AIDS?
It was actually fairly difficult. One of the things that the early ACT UP activists were doing was demanding speedier trials to get things to patients that they could actually use. Many of them facing an imminent mortality didn't want to wait for all the protocols to be done if there was a chance that the new drugs might help. I can remember a friend of mine willing to fly to San Francisco, where supposedly trials were underway, because he had no options here in Wisconsin at that point. So there was a lot of concern about whether a vaccine would occur. And contrary to President Trump's statement, there is no vaccine for AIDS at this point. There are treatment drugs, but not a vaccine.
Have treatment costs come down?
I'm not sure what the current prices are compared to what they were initially, but initially they were really quite high. That was another access issue. One of the things that we did learn, which apparently we've forgotten, is that healthcare is not equal across the systems, that minority and poor people have less access to healthcare and the potential solutions that the health system can provide than other folks in our society. And that's something we too easily forget.
How was the state of sexual health education?
Well, that was one of the other big lessons, is that how to have effective health education. There was a pamphlet that was used nationally and was distributed here in Wisconsin that was fairly frank about some of the transmission modes. And some of the politicians were objecting to using such descriptive behavior. And Secretary Rivets again responded that they weren't trying to reach the general public. They were trying to reach the public who really needed the information and who would understand it in ways that were not perhaps genteel, but that would be effective. Trying to make public health messages take effect is really one of the difficulties that we found in AIDS, and one of the things that apparently we're still dealing with now with COVID-19. People just want to not hear the lessons that public health has to teach.
What was it like inside public high schools and, public works in Wisconsin where people were trying to be educated and working and living with HIV/AIDS?
It could vary a lot. One of the things about high schools was that Milwaukee ACT UP distributed pamphlets for information and free condoms outside several high schools in the area. And Marquette High School objected strenuously to that. The Milwaukee Public Schools, while acknowledging their right to distribute, also was not crazy about it. But it was interesting that while after the sort of leafleting and handout of condoms, number of the leaflets were found strewn around on the pavement, but none of the condoms were. So maybe there was a little heartening that some of the high school students were willing to be open to the message of prevention.
We're looking back at the response to AIDS in Wisconsin amid the coronavirus pandemic. Our guide is author and activist Dick Wagner, who has studied the history of Wisconsin's gay community. With your history as well at 800-642-1234. Dick, I wonder, when did you see a turning point where we saw that things were going to change for people living with HIV? Because we're trying to find that turning point right now in the pandemic where we've wrestled with it and we think we have it under control, but we're not there yet. Where was that turning point for HIV and AIDS?
It didn't come till later in the 90s. And even then, it was sort of a little slow, really catching on. So there was over a decade and a half of when we really were struggling with AIDS. So, you know, God help us if we're a decade and a half struggling with COVID-19. But again, more resources are currently being directed on the COVID crisis than they were on the AIDS crisis. It was very slow to ramp up funding for research and prevention efforts over AIDS.
Did you see go ahead.
One of the things that struck me in thinking about this was that AIDS had very strong emotions associated with it. And ACT UP was one of those where the emotion was anger. The other emotion that was really significant was grief, and the gay community found ways to do creative expressions of that grief, the AIDS quilt being perhaps the most well-known example of that. But there were also artists who responded in various ways. We've seen a little bit of anger over the COVID crisis. We have not seen how creative grief can be. It's been largely suppressed, I think, in many ways, and I'm surprised at that.
When you look from the early 90s to later in the 90s, did you see an evolution there in terms of funding, in terms of research, and how the gay community was supported?
Yes, there was. One of the things I was involved with was helping establish the Rodney Scheel House for Persons with AIDS here in Madison. Senator Cole was a U.S. senator from Wisconsin then. He was very helpful in his office in getting the federal funds needed for that. And we worked very closely with local Madison officials to get the approvals for the siting of the buildings for the Rodney Scheel House. And so by the 90s, you'd started to find that political support was relatively good, but it was still a long, drawn-out fight.
What about stigma?
The stigma was still strong, and in fact, to this day, gay men are not supposed to be donating to blood banks because of that concern over the blood supply. Many of the stigmas attached to penalties against gays and the permission for marriage equality have changed some of that environment. But for people who were raised during that period, they carry those scars with them still today.
I'm sitting here looking at a picture of the AIDS Memorial quilt, and I'm wondering, when you see these images, and I'm sure you've seen so many images of the quilt, what goes through your mind?
It's a great sadness. I mean, I went to way too many funerals for young men in that period. And in 1987, when I was out in D.C. for the National March, I was one of the readers of names for the AIDS quilt. And it really was hard to try and express that grief. Shortly after that, I was invited to the war conference, which was trying to get a community response. The current president has talked about he's a wartime president. Well, we really felt we were in a wartime back then for the community, and we needed to marshal whatever resources, and they were few, that we could as part of a response to get a more positive message about the community out as we were facing this deadly peril.
How is the community holding up right now amid the pandemic? How are things?
I think we're battened down like most everybody else. There is a certain amount of fear again, and people talk about, my God, we got to go through another pandemic. Whereas I think for many Americans, this is their first pandemic. But for the gay community, it's like, here we go again.
Does it bring you any, maybe comfort is not the right word, but when you see Anthony Fauci up there in the press conferences and his long history with HIV/AIDS?
Right. I remember him from the old days.
Yeah. How does that make you feel?
I'm glad. I mean, he was one of the people who was out there trying to find solutions, and you know, his professionalism is still strong and still valuable to the nation. I would that we had many more like him in this fight.
Well, Dick, thank you so much for joining us. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Dick Wagner is an activist and author. We've been talking about the outbreak of AIDS in Wisconsin, comparing the public health response to the coronavirus outbreak. Coming up, we explore how police departments use surplus military gear in Wisconsin as demonstrations against police violence continue. How do you feel about police acquiring military gear through the Defense Department? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, police and protesters clashed in the streets, and in some cases, police brought armored vehicles and other military-grade equipment to the conflict. So should police departments receive excess gear from the military? What do you think of police responding to protests with mine-resistant vehicles? We're at 800-642-1234. Sarah Volpenhayn is a core member with Report for America covering minority communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We also have Nick Penzenstadler, who's a reporter for USA Today's investigative team. Nick, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, Nick, let's start with you. Give us more of a broader picture here. How much former military equipment is in the hands of our police departments since President Trump lifted Obama-era restrictions?
Yeah, so this program dates back to the 90s. And if you look at that window, there are about 8,000 agencies around the country that have requested this material, and it's about $6 billion worth of everything from planes and vehicles, helicopters, down to, you know, gloves and night vision goggles. And, you know, the history was after the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson and the protests there, President Obama reined this program in a little bit and put some restrictions on it. And then in 2017, the Trump administration reversed that. So our study looked at since that timeline in 17, what has happened. And just since then, it's $450 million worth of gear that has flowed out to these agencies.
Sarah, give us a sense of what types of equipment have Wisconsin police agencies received through the Defense Department program?
Sure. So like Nick was saying, it can range from, you know, more mundane things like office supplies, first aid kits, things like that, to the more controversial items like mine-resistant armored protected vehicles or ambush-protected vehicles or MRAPs, which, you know, were built for the battlefield to withstand IED explosions over in Iraq and Afghanistan. Also things like M16s and M14 rifles. So what we found was that Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have more than $45 million worth of surplus military equipment in their possession, and that about $28.7 million worth of that is in mine-resistant vehicles like MRAPs.
How much does each vehicle cost?
They range. On the high end, it's about $700,000 for some of the MRAPs. But then there's also some lighter tactical vehicles that can be from $300,000 to $400,000, something like that.
Nick, what is the process? Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to add, too, that usually the law enforcement agencies receive these at no cost or just the cost of shipping and transportation. So these are usually just transferred from the Department of Defense with, you know, very little cost to law enforcement agencies.
Nick, what is the protocol for receiving this equipment? How do these agencies ask for it? And is there some type of competition or bidding process, if you will?
It's more like a registry. So as a law enforcement agency, you have to sign up and be qualified through the program. And then there's almost like a catalog of what's available. And I talked to some police agencies that just stock the program. If they want something, they look, you know, daily or weekly to see what's coming up, and then they put in their request for it. And then it's reviewed by the Pentagon, and then you get chosen and they ship it out. So you basically get vetted, sign up, and then they ship it to you.
What has been the most common piece of equipment in Wisconsin that is procured through these agencies?
I would probably think that would be rifles. A lot of policing agencies request rifles. And usually it's the less expensive items that, you know, like rifles or other kinds of equipment that you see law enforcement agencies requesting. But in terms of price, if you look purely at the value of the equipment, the most in dollar figures that is requested from law enforcement agencies are those mine-resistant vehicles.
We're talking about police using surplus military gear. Sarah Volpenhain is here from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Nick Penzenstadler from USA Today. You can join in. How do you feel about police officers arriving at protests with armored vehicles? What do you think of military equipment transfers? Join in 800-642-1234. Sarah, how have Wisconsin law enforcement used this equipment during the most recent protests?
Sure. So this kind of heavy equipment was spotted on Milwaukee streets during the protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd. Now, it's worth mentioning that the Milwaukee Police Department and the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office do not have a mine-resistant vehicle through this program. But a lot of nearby police agencies do, like the Waukesha Police Department, West Allis, Greenfield, as well as the Racine County Sheriff's Office. And those agencies provided mine-resistant vehicles when they were assisting in the response to the protests that were going on. And, you know, law enforcement, when you talk to them, they point to the, you know, volatility, especially in the early days of the protests. You know, an officer was shot at one point. You know, businesses were looted or burned, and people were kind of driving recklessly through the streets during those early days. But critics, you know, say that this kind of equipment is too militarized, that, you know, it's being deployed against everyday citizens, that, you know, this is exactly what protesters are protesting against in the first place, is overreaction or over-response by the police. And, you know, they say this type of equipment often leads to escalation and doesn't help to de-escalate the situation or to inspire, you know, trust in the police.
Nick, what have you heard from the police departments you've talked with about why they go after this equipment?
Well, I mean, obviously they see it as a cost-saving measure, and, you know, they say at a time when they're stretched thin, this is only going to help with equipment and the capital investment that they would otherwise be putting into a municipal budget. And then, you know, you talk to some of these small-town agencies that say, you know, we face the same threat oftentimes as some of the bigger, more well-funded police agencies, and when we have a barricaded subject or a subject who's threatening our officers, you know, we want to have some type of cover or have the type of equipment that we can match, you know, what we're up against. So they only see the plus sides of it. You know, but there is obviously the concern about how it looks and what message they're sending to the community. So I think you're seeing some of those agencies reconsider how they use them and in what situation they use them in, and if there is community buy into what they're doing.
Nick, how transparent are they about their acquisitions past and present?
Well, it's a public record for anybody like us who wants to go see. And when you do call to confirm, they're pretty open about, you know, yes, we requested this, or no, we sent it back. And one of the pieces that the Obama administration put in was to get approval from local like oversight boards if you were going to get some of these more restricted items. And although that had been changed in the most recent iteration in 2017, a lot of agencies we found still do that. So if a community is looking at getting one of these mine resistant trucks, they'll often put it on their agenda for the city council to at least weigh in and consider it, and maybe have that discussion. So I know that that was one of the reforms that I think people thought was pretty measured and worthwhile.
And you talked with the police chief in Superior who returned their mine resistant armored vehicle.
Yeah, Chief Alexander told us that, you know, in 2018 when he took over, I think he just decided that, one, it was too big. A lot of times these agencies say these giant hulking diesel trucks just are a lot to manage. They're more than they need. And there are, you know, tactical trucks that are built for police. So he traded up for this more like a Bearcat, it's called, that's also armored but not quite as big. And he also said, you know, they're sensitive to what the community feels that they need. And Superior, Wisconsin, you know, decided they did not need a mine resistant truck.
Sarah, how have people that you've talked to responded to their local police departments receiving this equipment?
Well, for this story, I talked to the ACLU, who, you know, says that this is, you know, scary and intimidating to people to, you know, see a police officer armed with a rifle, you know, popping out of the hatch of an MRAP while they're protesting. Obviously, they're going to have a much more critical view of this. But that's the view that I heard from at least the ACLU.
Mm-hmm. Nick, take us to Capitol Hill. I understand, you know, House and Senate Democrats are looking to limit this military surplus program. What do they have their sights set on?
Yeah, so they have introduced, as part of their policing reform bill, a pretty much complete ban on these transfers. And it's interesting talking to former military folks. They say that, you know, from the military's perspective, this is probably more of a headache than it's worth. And it also represents a really small fraction of what the U.S. has in surplus equipment. And, I think they do it because the police like it, and it's definitely a public relations type piece, but they'd rather scrap it too. So, you know, as you mentioned, there is a bill pending in Congress to do away with this altogether. But we already talked to, you know, the nation's leading police union, who would oppose this piece of reform. Of all of the reforms being introduced, including, you know, banning chokeholds and this registry of bad cops, this particular prong is one thing that police don't want to see go away.
Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sarah Volpenhayn is a core member with Report for America, covering minority communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Nick Penzenstadler, reporter for USA Today's investigative team. Coming up, we hear about the return of Northwood League baseball in 5 Wisconsin communities this week. That's after in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Checking in on summer baseball in Wisconsin here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. 5 Wisconsin teams return to the plate this week for collegiate-level baseball in the Northwoods League, but teams in Madison, Beloit, and elsewhere have canceled their seasons. How are you feeling about the return of sports amid the pandemic? Are you going to any games? Are you an athlete or coach? How are you staying safe? We're at 800-642-1234. Bern Stenman is president of Big Top Sports and Entertainment and co-owner of the Green Bay Booyah and the Kenosha Kingfish. Bern, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So for the teams headed back to the field this week, how are they looking at safety?
Well, we've been working really closely with the public health departments in each of the communities that we have teams that we run. And that's been our focus, has been safety and figuring out kind of innovative ways to create a safe experience for our fans to enjoy coming out to baseball games.
Yeah, what does that safety look like? How do you ensure social distancing? I mean, this is not a sport that really lends itself to social distancing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, basically what we're doing is we're operating with kind of reduced capacity seating maps. And so we're opening up for sale about 25% of our seating throughout the stadiums. And so we actually, our team in Green Bay, the Green Bay Booyah, started their season up on Wednesday night and played their first game. And a full sellout crowd there is probably close to 4,000 people in that stadium. And on Wednesday night, we had about 800 people in the stadium. Every other row was closed, and no groups from different households were seated closer than about 6 feet from each other throughout the stadium. We had extensive sanitation guidelines in place. We closed the bathroom, I think, every 30 minutes to go in and do a complete sanitization of the bathroom. We were cleaning handrails throughout the game and things like that. We had, of course, stickers on the floor for keeping lines and queuing for concessions and restrooms and things like that distanced out. And the response so far has been really positive, you know, on social media, of course, where everyone goes to kind of give their feelings about things. People said the kinds of things we were hoping to see. They said they felt safe. They said they were impressed with how our staff operated and handled, the safety concerns that people have right now.
I mean, you listed off a lot of measures in the setup and carry out of these games. It's a lot of logistics, I would imagine, to juggle.
Certainly, yeah. And it's hard, of course. We're small businesses, right? And it's expensive and things like that to go out and do this. But we understood that risk when we started, and we wanted to try to bring baseball back to these communities. I think that's an important thing that we provide is fun for these communities that we operate in the summertime. And I think everyone needs a little bit of that type of escape right now. And if there's a safe way to do it, these different communities, we wanted to try to pursue that.
Are the players tested on a regular basis, or how does testing work?
Players were all tested when they came into town. And we quarantined them until we got the results before they went to go stay with their host families for the summer.
We're talking about the return of Northwoods League Baseball with Vern Stenman from Big Top Sports and Entertainment. Do you live in Fond du Lac, Green Bay, La Crosse, Wausau, Wisconsin Rapids? What do you think about the return of baseball in your town? Will you go to a game this summer? Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Vern, Kenosha now has two teams in the league that will play each other 26 times starting July 15th. How is that going to work out?
Well, you know, first of all, I really applaud the Northwoods League for taking a pretty innovative approach for how these teams can play and really being open to a lot of different things. And so basically, as we were working through with the different health departments in the communities we work in, you know, everyone looked at it differently and had a different kind of timeline, and they were in different phases at different points and had different local issues that they had to prioritize, of course. And cause so Green Bay was ready to go on July 1st, this past Wednesday. Kenosha felt like July 15th was going to be the right time for their community. And because of that, what we did is ended up putting a second kind of a new startup Northwoods League team in Kenosha. We rebranded or created a new brand, I guess. We're going to call them the K-Town Bobbers. Our team in Kenosha is the Kingfish right now. And so it's kind of a fun little interplay back and forth. And in Madison, our team is not going to be allowed to return to play. So we actually took our coaches and some of our players from our Madison roster and added them in with some new players going to Kenosha this year to create the K-Town Bobbers roster. They'll play every Wednesday or Thursday through Sunday at Historic Sevens Field in Kenosha, and they'll just play each other.
So well, I'm surprised. I'm surprised the name didn't for the startup didn't reflect the pandemic in any way.
We did a name the team contest, and we certainly had some fun, some middles. But you know, again, like I think we've always looked at ourselves as an escape from those types of things, be it politics, be it whatever isn't fun in your life right now. You know, like, we don't want to bring that into the ballpark if we can help it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always kind of called ourselves a nine-inning vacation, and I think we wanted to kind of stay away from that as much as we could.
Remind us where these players come from.
They're summer collegiate baseball players, so they're the best amateur players in the entire country. Our teams will have players from, you know, the University of Florida to UCLA to, you know, even state school here in Wisconsin, like I'm trying to think of, you know, UW Oshkosh and places like that will have players on the roster as well. The league has expanded the rosters as well. Since these guys haven't played baseball in about 4 months, taking a little bit longer for them to kind of get back into playing shape, and we'll actually carry 35 guys on a roster this year.
And you say they stay with the host family. How does that work?
Yes, it's another really cool way that our teams have been able to integrate with these communities really closely, is that when they come into town, they, you know, they're 19 to 21, 22 years old. They're all, they also have eligibility to play college baseball, so they're all still attending school. And so they live in a family in our community. The family gets free season tickets for taking care of our players for the summer, and they really become a nice, you know, connection, I suppose, between our team and the community, and they become some of our biggest fans.
So as these initial games play out, and let's say they go pretty smoothly, do you have any intention of expanding the summer, adding more teams?
Certainly not more teams.
Okay.
You know, I think that we'll continue to work with the public health departments in these communities and see what happens, you know, and if they think we can increase our capacity in the future, we might. You know, what I've seen so far, I attended the game in Wisconsin Rapids last night as well, where they had about 650 people in their stadium. It felt about right. You know, I think we're at a good spot right now with where we're looking at things and how people are spaced out. And I think we'll want to wait a couple weeks at least to see what's next and what the right thing to do is, and follow the guidance of our public health officials.
How many masks did you see last night at the game?
Oh, boy, I couldn't say an exact number. And again, I think you're going to see every county is going to be very different. I think Wood County, where Wisconsin Rapids is, only has 44 cases or something like that. So I think you're going to see in different places, people are going to wear masks reflective of how big the situation in their community is.
Really quickly on the issue of soccer here, Big Top Sports and Entertainment also runs a soccer team in the USL League One. How has that season been?
Yeah, we're still working through the details there. That league, that season is still has not started. They're working towards a mid to late July launch of that season, but nothing's really quite finalized yet as we look at the plans.
Are there any? I mean, is it more difficult to figure this out for soccer or baseball?
Well, I think the health departments have classified baseball and soccer as medium risk sports. So they're kind of looked at through the same lens from a public health perspective. So I think that, you know, and they've also looked at the mass gathering around it through the same lens. So they've been kind of handled similarly to this point.
Well, Vern, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Vern Stenman, president of Big Top Sports and Entertainment, talking about the return of Northwoods League baseball to Wisconsin. Just ahead, it's another edition of our Explorers Club. We have members of the group Andrew and Polly, who love to write silly songs, give us earworms. Kids, do you love to sing or dance? Tell us about the song you can't get out of your head. Parents, lend a hand as usual, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.